Okay, please turn to Jeremiah chapter 17. I decided to split the study into 2 weeks. I'll read the whole chapter this week, but only be covering the first 13 verses. Chapter 17. The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron. With the point of a diamond it is engraved on the tablet of their heart and on the horns of your altars. While their children remember their altars and their wooden images by the green trees on the high hills. O my mountain in the field, I will give as plunder your wealth, all your treasures, and your high places of sin within all your borders. And you, even yourself, shall let go of the heritage which I gave you, and I will cause you to serve your enemies in the land which you do not know. For you have kindled a fire in my anger, which shall burn forever. Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man, and makes flesh his strength, whose heart departs from the Lord. For he shall be like a shrub in the desert, and shall not see when good comes, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness, and a salt land which is not inhabited. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, and whose hope is in the Lord. For he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, which spreads out its roots by the river, and will not fear when heat comes, but its leaf will be green. It will not be anxious in the year of drought, nor will cease from yielding fruit. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. As a partridge that broods but does not hatch, so is he who gets riches, but not by right. It will leave him in the midst of his days, and at his end, he will be a fool. A glorious high throne from the beginning is the place of our sanctuary. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you shall be ashamed. Those who depart from me shall be written in the earth, because they have forsaken the Lord, the fountain of living waters. Heal me, O Lord, and I shall be healed. Save me, and I shall be saved, for you are my praise. Indeed, they say to me, where is the word of the Lord? Let it come now. As for me, I have not hurried away from being a shepherd who follows you, nor have I desired the woeful day. You know what came out of my lips. It was right there before you. Do not be a terror to me, for you are my hope in the day of doom. Let them be ashamed to persecute me, but do not let me be put to shame. Let them be dismayed, but do not let me be dismayed. Bring on them the day of doom, and destroy them with double destruction. Thus the Lord said to me, go and stand in the gate of the children of the people, by which the kings of Judah come in and by which they go out, and in all the gates of Jerusalem, and say to them, hear the word of the Lord, you kings of Judah, and all Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem who enter by these gates. Thus says the Lord, take heed to yourselves and bear no burden on the Sabbath day, nor bring it in by the gates of Jerusalem, nor carry a burden out of your houses on the Sabbath day, nor do any work, but hallow the Sabbath day as I commanded your fathers. But they did not hear, they did not obey, nor incline their ear, but made their necks stiff, that they might not hear nor receive instruction. And it shall be, if you heed me carefully, says the Lord, to bring no burden through the gates of this city on the Sabbath day, but hallow the Sabbath day to do no work on it, in it, then shall enter the gates of this city kings and princes, sitting on the throne of David, riding in chariots and on horses, they and their princes, accompanied by the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And this city shall remain forever. And they shall come from the cities of Judah and from the places around Jerusalem, from the land of Benjamin, from the lowland, from the mountains and from the south, bringing burnt offerings and sacrifices, grain offerings and incense, bringing sacrifices of praise to the house of the Lord. But if you will not heed me to hallow the Sabbath day, such as not carrying a burden when entering the gates of Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, then I will kindle a fire in its gates, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem, and it shall not be quenched. All right, as I said, I decided to divide the study into two parts. We'll be looking at verses 1 through 13, Lord willing, today, and then the rest next week. The division is not a very easy one in the sense there are a lot of connected sections, but they could be divided in different ways. So this part of the chapter especially emphasizes the contrast, which you see again and again in the scriptures, and I guess as Bruce pointed out last week, especially in the Psalms, the contrast between the way of the wicked and the way of the righteous. And to summarize, the way of the wicked is a way of hardened sin, a way of unfruitfulness and barrenness and loneliness, and a way of destruction and judgment. Whereas the way of the righteous is a way of peace and joy, a way of fruitfulness and of blessing, especially in fellowship with God. There could hardly be a starker contrast in this chapter between those two ways. And that starts out focusing in the first, I'll split it up in verses 1 through 4, on the sin of the people. Now, of course, this is a theme which Jeremiah has touched on again and again, the desperate condition of the people and how ripe they are for judgment. There's a new angle on it, though, in these verses, especially the opening verses. Actually, one would be tempted to spend the whole class on verse 1. It's a very interesting picture that's given. Their sin is described here as New King James has it, written with a pen of iron. The word pen of iron is the word that would be used for an engraver's tool. And the written is as etched or engraved to go with that. And the idea is that their sin is indelibly marked. Indelibly marked on, we might add as a secondary part of this, a very hard surface, which is their heart. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Their sin is pictured here as something which is etched on them. Their idolatry is deeply engraved in their hearts. We might we have the English phrase set in stone, and that's the idea here. Their sin, their habit of idolatry is set in stone. Now, that has to do both with the actual sin, that is that they have this propensity to idolatry, this habit of wickedness, as well as the fact that the guilt adheres to them in the same way. So, you know, when we say sin, sometimes we mean sin in the sense of the propensity to wickedness or the actual act of evil, but also sometimes we mean the guilt that is attached to sin. And I think both of these ideas are here. It is because they are so inclined to idolatry that their guilt also clings to them. This picture, of course, is in some ways a very terrifying one. The picture of writing on a tablet goes back at least to the Ten Commandments, which were written by the finger of God on the tablets of stone. But, of course, the idea appears elsewhere, and ultimately it appears in a positive way in Jeremiah. You're going to hold your finger there. Turn to Jeremiah 31:33. This is a familiar passage, but the ultimate contrast between the sin of idolatry, their wickedness being written on their hearts, and the work of the Spirit is a very striking one. This is one of the new covenant promises in Jeremiah 31. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. So whereas their sin was indelibly written on their hearts, God says that he will indelibly write his law on our hearts, which can only be a work of his Spirit in connection with his regeneration, the giving of a new heart. Now, that picture is terrifying enough, as I said, but as Calvin points out, they could well have said, well, Jeremiah, how do you know what's in our hearts? And Jeremiah had a ready answer, that is, that what was in their hearts showed up in their lives, and It always does so, of course, but in this case in particular, it says it's not only written on a tablet of their heart, but at the end of verse 1, on the horns of their altars. Now, the next verse talks about idolatry in the sense of breaking the first commandment. Verse 2 is especially focused on the worship of other gods. But I think what's going on at the end of verse 1 on the horns of their altars would be the altar in the temple. And the point would be, even the sacrifice they pretend to offer to God is, as it were, etched with their sinfulness. Or to use the metaphor here, that even the blood they sprinkle on the altar writes out their own sinfulness. Now, that may be a hard idea to relate to, but if you think back to, put the reference up here, chapter 7, remember God says that he wants no more of their sacrifices. They are hypocrites. They only come to him with their mouths, but their lives are completely inconsistent with it. So much so that, for example, in Isaiah it says, you know, I detest your offerings. And I think that's the point here, to say that their sin is written on the blood of their altars, is that even as they pretend to be faithful followers of God, their very act of offering him worship only adds to the writing against them and the testimony of their sinfulness. Now, in any case, it's made plain that they're hypocrites in verse 2, that they profess to be God's people, while in verse 2 they worship idols. And this is language which is familiar in the prophets: wooden images, green trees on the high hills. Those are all places where, in the worst of times, sacrifices were offered to the pagan gods. Those were the original locations of pagan worship, on the high hills. And so he says, in effect here, that your sin is not only displayed in your heart, but it's writ large in your geography, as it were. It's all over the place. You can see their wickedness. Even so much that their children are involved. I guess I joked before in chapter 7 that they had good family values. They involved their children in the whole practice, and their children, in the worst cases, were involved in the sense that they were offered as sacrifices. But here, I think the idea is the children know the practice. They're intimately involved in your idolatrous worship. That then is the allegation against them. And then the judgment that comes in verses 3 and 4 is may look familiar. It's very similar to chapter 15, verses 13 and 14. So I won't spend much time on it. But I would like to comment on one thing. God, in essence, says that he will give everything, all their wealth, over to judgment, that they will go into captivity, as it makes plain in verse 4. There's an interesting phrase here in the New King James. It says, you even yourself shall let go of your heritage. And that verb, let go of, is used in the book of Exodus in the command to let the land lie fallow. You know, every 7 years they weren't supposed to plow the land. They were supposed to let it have its Sabbath, as it were. And that same verb that's used there, to let the land lie fallow, to let it rest, as it were, is used here. And I think that's connected then with what happens at the end of the chapter, the reference to their violating the weekly Sabbath. God says, in effect, if you won't let my land rest, I'll let it rest by kicking you out of it. No longer will you be there to till it as you were before. So that, I put up some references there to that. But the special point of this is an important one, and that is that the sinfulness of these men, and I think we can say men generally who are dead in trespasses and sins, is so indelibly marked on the heart that it requires the work of grace to change the heart and to erase the sin, the guilt, and to give a new heart. And that idea has been taken up, I put up the reference in 2 Corinthians 3 by the Apostle Paul, referring to the work of his ministry. Let me pause there. I said I could take a long time on that first verse, but I didn't take as long as I could. Any comments or questions so far? There's less competition this week there. So raise your hand and know that I'll call on you. That doesn't mean I'll give you more chances to talk, but okay. The next section I'd like to look at is verses 5 through 8, and here is especially where the contrast between the way of the wicked and the way of the righteous is very sharply drawn. This may look familiar, especially verses 7 and 8 should remind you of Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly, and so forth. And the figure of the tree planted by the waters. That's in Psalm 1. And the additional aspect here is I think, really helpful. If that's the way the godly man is, then what is the ungodly man like? And I'd like to point that out by way of contrast. So I'm going to attempt this here. So we'll try a kind of literary comparison between 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. Maybe not very literary, but so first of all, of course, the contrast is between cursed in verse 5 and blessed. One man is under the judgment and curse of God, and the other enjoys God's blessing. Now, what is the basic contrast between the two men, or the two, you might say, seeds, to pick up with our pastor's preaching in Genesis? Well, it is first in verse 5 that the man who is cursed is one who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength. Now, flesh isn't used in the Gnostic sense. That would be pretty strange since the Gnostics were still in the future. It's not used in the Gnostic sense of, you know, flesh like material. Flesh is a word which is used in parallel to man here. Trusting in the power of men, especially, is the point here. It may be your own strength, your own flesh, or maybe the flesh of others. But that's, man is used in parallel to flesh here in the Hebrew of way of writing poetry. And the contrast is trusting in man versus, of course, in verse 7, trusting in the Lord and hoping in the Lord. And that gets to the heart, you see, of the difference. The gospel isn't just in the New Testament, of course we know. The way of the righteous is the way of faith. The way of the wicked, and faith in God, the way of the wicked is the way of faith in man. And that basic contrast is what underlies all of the New Testament religion and all of the Old Testament religion. It's not an outward ceremony only. It is fundamentally a matter of the heart. Don't ever let anyone mislead you on that point. Fundamentally, it's a matter of the heart. What do you trust in, or whom do you trust in? But there's an extra addition in verse 5 which is very striking. You know, we might say, well, I rely on this man or that man, either corporately or individually. I'll try to come back to the application at the end of the contrasts. You might say, well, it's not that bad. But notice what the end of verse 5 says. Trusting in man is departing from the Lord. It's a pretty striking statement, isn't it? You might say, I can trust in man and still trust in God too. And there's a certain sense in which you can do that, maybe a subordinate sense. But here, the striking contrast is, if you trust in flesh, then you are departing from the Lord. There is no way of combining the two. There is no way of faithfulness to God, which also trusts in the flesh. The contrast is then developed in a striking way by the image here. Now, in verse 6, it's a shrub in the desert. Now, this was a tamarisk, a kind of a dwarf juniper, which lived in very desolate areas. It was a very ugly plant, very unattractive, and a useless plant. One is tempted to compare it to the what we call cedars in our pastures, which I think actually aren't junipers technically in some cases. So if you like, think of all those things that sprout out all over the pasture. They're just useless. I wish we could get rid of the things. So maybe they're not quite as ugly as these were. But that's the basic, the ungodly man is pictured as a shrub in the desert. In contrast, in verse 8, the blessed man, the one who trusts in the Lord, is one who is like a tree planted by the waters. And not only is it planted by the waters, and this is actually an addition to the picture in Psalm 1, there's something of a dynamic here. He's not only planted by the waters, but his roots spread out toward the water, which of course is what plants do, right? When they're near a water source, they're going to tend to spread their roots in that direction. They spread out their roots by the river. Now that basic picture then is drawn out further. If the shrub is an unattractive and unfruitful sort of thing, it lives in a parched place, a salt land which is not inhabited, it's a lonely, it's a very unpleasant picture, then what is the picture of the tree? It bears fruit. Well, it says at the end of verse 8, nor will it cease from yielding fruit. Its leaf will be green. It's useful. It's attractive. It's fruitful. What's especially striking, though, is the fact that, in a sense, the environments are the same. Now, you have to understand when I say that, of course, one of them is living in the desert and the other is living by the streams of water. So when I say the environments are the same, what I'm getting at is, it says in verse 6, it shall not see when good comes. Now, good would especially be for a desert plant, rain. And that even that use of the word good is in Deuteronomy 28. I put the reference up there. But the point is that even when rain comes, it won't be any benefit to this plant. It won't even know that anything good has happened. Okay? But what about the good tree? Does it enjoy only good times? And the answer is no. It doesn't enjoy only good times, at least as far as the environment goes. It says in verse 8, it will not fear or see when heat comes. It will not be anxious in the year of drought. See, it doesn't say that it won't experience drought. What it says is that it won't fear or suffer from the drought. The contrast is that when the wicked man has good come his way, he doesn't even see it. Whereas when the wicked man sees good, he doesn't even enjoy it or understand it. Whereas here, when the blessed man goes through times of suffering, and that's the implication, certainly there will be times of suffering, he doesn't see it in this sense, that he is not shaken to the foundation, or to use the metaphor here, he's not shaken because he has deep roots. So it's a really wonderful picture, because it describes the experience, for example, in the Psalms again and again. You know, the righteous man in Psalm 37, for example, may suffer lots of things, but because he has roots by the water, he ultimately has no cause to fear. He is refreshed from a source that the wicked man cannot see. So the shrub wonders, how does the tree endure the drought? And the answer is, he's got roots by the water. And it's that deep rootedness of the believer's life which enables men to undergo tremendous sufferings. Okay, so to come to examples, as I said I would, take Jeremiah. Jeremiah would have understood this pretty well. I mean, he had 40 years of drought, as it were, his ministry among the people. People trying to kill him, telling him to shut up. They didn't want to hear what he had to say. You know, mocking him, as we read in the last part of the chapter. When is all this judgment going to come, Jeremiah? You've been telling us about it. When is it going to come? And yet he was like a tree by the rivers, because his source of strength was in the fountain of living waters, to mix the metaphors and jump ahead a bit in the chapter. Now, that contrast then with Jeremiah as the faithful one should be taken not only on the individual level, but on the corporate level. The trusting in the flesh was something which the Israelites were particularly prone to do in the corporate level. They looked to Egypt, for example, for political resources. Sometimes they looked to Egypt, and then when they didn't like Egypt, they'd look east back again. So they'd play off, they tried to play off, it never worked very well. The two world powers that were present, Egypt and Assyria, or Egypt and Babylon. But that was the temptation again and again. And I let me just read one of these. They're similar verses that spell out this trust in the flesh, I should say, both in Isaiah chapter 30 and in Isaiah chapter 31 at the beginning. Let me just read verse 1 of Isaiah 31. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but who do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord. You see, there's the basic contrast. They're trusting in Egypt. They're trusting in the resources of these other countries and not looking to God. So that temptation is there on an on a corporate level, and as we've tried to apply Jeremiah, especially say in this case, there's a temptation for the church in our day to look to other sources of strength and not to look to the Lord. And it's also true on an individual level. After all, what is justification by faith alone, or through faith alone, by grace alone mean, but abandoning all trust in our flesh? We have no hope in our works at all. We have only hope in God. And that fundamental contrast, of course, as I said, underlies the Christian life, whether speaking as a Christian anachronistically in the Old Testament believer's case or in the New Testament. Trusting in your flesh is a sure way to cursing and judgment. Trusting in the righteousness of Christ is the true way to blessing. So, that's the basic contrast. In wonderful passages like this, I often feel it's better for me to shut up and let the passage speak for itself. It's so rich. Any comments or questions so far on this section? I saw Rob's hand first.
Well, I was thinking that if somebody were to come across these two trees and they ask the question, well, somebody says, well, I wonder why this tree is flourishing and the other one's not. Somebody else would say, well, it's because there's a water right here. So there's a clear connection between the, you know, it's not like there was an underground water where there wasn't any evidence of why that tree was. It's easy to see why it is. And I was just thinking that in our lives, it needs to be easy to see why we're flourishing in drought and prospering in hard times, because there is a clear testimony of trusting in God.
Yeah, and that's something we actually have to work at, in the sense of, you know, just saying, well, I'm happy because I'm a happy person. Yeah, that's a good point. That we need to make the effort to make that testimony clear.
So I think it's important that the metaphor not be an underground stream, but rather an obvious...
That's a good point.
Because it doesn't do any good to the testimony of the Lord if there's no external evidence of why somebody is saying...
There is a type of trusting in man that is allowed. It's not brought out in this passage.
Right.
So, that's why you didn't cover it. But.
Yeah, this is talking about two ways of life. And if you're characterizing...
Trusting in man for your salvation in any way, of course, that's not allowed.
Right. But, and it's, you know, we rely... We rely on our parents to provide for us when we're children. We have a certain trust in the police to defend us. You know, there are all kinds of ways in which the society is set up, and the point is ultimately those can fail us, and that's why our ultimate hope has to be in God.
Right.
But yeah, that's right. Often the Bible draws very stark contrasts, which when you try to apply it, you know, if you try to apply it in that same stark way, you'll walk around completely defenseless, right? And say, I'm not going to go live on your own or something.
Isn't the distinction, though, that those are the means by which trust in God is worked out in history, as compared to looking to those things as the means, or, you know, looking to the government as the source, and then the means is the government. Maybe that's not a very clear way of saying it, but there is a means. I mean, you know, it's just like the rain. The farmer, if he looks to the physics of the rain cycle as his hope, he's missed the point. But if he looks to the Lord to provide the rain, either way, the rain is still the means by which his crops are refreshed.
It can even be applied to things that God has commanded us to do. I mean, if you're trusting that when you're sprinkled by water, you're saved, then you're trusting in that outward work.
Right.
But we're commanded to do it. It's not going to save us by doing it.
Right. I guess I pointed this out before, but I found the Larger Catechism commentary on the First Commandment helpful. One of the sins against the First Commandment is using unlawful means, which everyone can agree is bad, but also trusting in lawful means. So that trusting in your baptism would be an example. You don't want to neglect the means that God has appointed, but on the other hand, to look at it as the source and to ignore that it's only God who can save is clearly an idolatrous sort of thing. So it's good.
Where God never fails us, and God, we never have to worry that He's ever going to fail us.
That's a really good point. And that was pictured so well because, Egypt failed them and Babylon failed them. They had the lesson written again and again, which we see on an individual level. But this stream is an unfailing stream. That's a very good point. As I said, these sections are tied together, and I think the point that Sue made actually is a good segue, if that's the buzzword, into verses 9 through 11. That is... trust in man is a foolish thing because man don't even know their own hearts. As one commentator points out, if you can't trust in man, you certainly can't trust in your own heart. So verse 9 is one of the famous verses out of Jeremiah. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Let me make just some brief comments on the words that are used here. The word deceitful is related to the word from which Jacob got his name. How Jacob deceived his brother on more than one occasion, actually. Jacob was a supplanter. And I put up the one reference in Genesis 27 where his brother actually complains, he's just like his name. So this is the idea. In a sense, the whole of... all descendants of Adam, all fallen men, are Jacob's. Their hearts are deceitful. Above all things, supremely deceitful. And the other thing I would comment on is the desperately wicked. Many of the modern translations and many of the commentators point out that the word which is translated wicked there actually is translated elsewhere incurable. So I put up a reference in Jeremiah 15 that we've already seen, an incurable wound. And even in this chapter, verse 16, there it is, the woeful day. That word woeful is the same word. So it is true that the point, I think, of the desperately wicked is that the case is beyond cure. The case is hopeless. And in that sense, a medical metaphor is pretty helpful. We've all heard of situations where the doctors more or less give up hope. And they say, he's going to die. The case is beyond treatment. It's a hopeless case. And that's fine. I think that's probably the point of the metaphor. And the word desperately only underlies that. It's desperately hopeless. If there's a need for redundancy there. The only comment I would add on that is that this, of course, doesn't support the modern psychological notion of sin as a disease, right? People think that removes the responsibility of sin. Then, if sin is just a disease, then there's no responsibility on the person. The Bible wasn't written in the context of modern psychology. So when it says desperately wicked, okay, probably is using a medical metaphor of a wound which is incurable. And desperately so, but forget all that other stuff. This is a very striking statement again because it emphasizes the deviousness of the human heart. The heart is deceitful above all things. I thought I would read. I've already skipped over a bunch of quotes that I was going to read, but let me read what Matthew Henry says here. The heart, the conscience of man, in his corrupt and fallen state, is deceitful above all things. It is subtle and false. It is apt to supplant, so the word properly signifies, again referring to Jacob. It is that from which Jacob had his name, a supplanter. It calls evil good and good evil, puts false colors upon things, and cries peace, and cries peace to those to whom peace does not belong. This is a very, very important thing to remember for evangelism. You know, when we think of deceitful hearts, well, I think we've all known people who are just shifty. You know you can't trust these guys. They'll trick you on anything. And I'll have to confess I've had students like this at the university. But that's not what this is talking about only. This is talking about that very sincere person who says, you know, I've searched for God long and hard, and I've made my peace that all ways to God are right. You have to keep in mind that the person who seems very sincere and says that is a person described by this verse. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Don't trust your heart. You know, that's kind of the mantra of the Disney-fied humanism, that is just trust in your heart and everything will be all right. Especially with regard to the unbeliever, you should say, don't trust your heart. Because your heart will lie to you every time. Your heart will say that you're just about as good as anyone else, or even better, and that God will be kind to you and just wink at your sin. Don't trust your heart, this verse says, above all things. And even there is a word in this to the believer as well. I put up the reference to Psalm 139. Although our hearts have been made new by the work of the Spirit, still the psalmist encourages us, in fact, prays in Psalm 139, "Search me, O Lord, and know my heart." We have to admit that we still need God to search our hearts, even after he has worked in us. And then, of course, I guess I'm getting ahead of things. Who can know it is the question at the end of verse 9. Of course, the answer is no man can know it. No man can plumb the depths of the wickedness and deceitfulness of the human heart. But, now that would be a despairing if the verse stopped there. Who can know it? Because if the wound is incurable, if the case is desperate, then we're all doomed to destruction, right? But not only is verse 10 a word of judgment, but it's also, in a sense, a word of hope, because it says, "I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind." In the original, that's actually the kidneys, which, you know, the seat of affection as well as thought are in the heart and kidneys in the Hebrew way of thinking. "Even to give to every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings." That idea that God is the only one who knows the thoughts of men. Men can't know the thoughts of men. God is the only one who searches out the thoughts of men. Then is closely connected with the fact that God is the only just judge. Right? That's why when we're ill-treated by men, we can commit ourselves to God's keeping, because he knows all things. And he is the one who acts justly in the end. And so there is the thought not only that he is the only physician who can cure this heart, and I think that's part of what Jeremiah is pointing out in the beginning of the next section as I divided up the chapter in verse 14, which we'll look at next week, Lord willing, heal me. Not only is God the only possible physician, but he's also the only possible true judge who gives men justly according to their works. Now here I restrained myself and didn't put up any cross references, because there are a whole bunch of them, to the fact that God is the one who knows the heart, and God is the one who judges justly according to every man's works. Any comments or questions on that short section? That's only two verses. You see now why I divided the chapter into 2 weeks? It's packed with it. It's got lots of really good stuff in it.
I think it's good encouragement in two ways. One is that it's really wrong to compare ourselves to others. You know that we have a relationship with the Lord that's to do with us, and that God knows our hearts and God is amazing. So often man compares them with all these things that are not the same. And I think it's that we just can have confidence in the fact that he's ours, and we can trust him, and even if things are going wrong, that we can trust him. Where we can't necessarily rely on other people to be consistent.
That's right. Yeah, so again, it ties back to the earlier verses of trusting in the Lord only. And that idea that you put forth is what Jeremiah again uses as a comfort. He also asks God to search him, and I didn't put this reference up, and I bet I won't be able to put my finger on it. Just for example, in Jeremiah 15:15, "O Lord, you know," he says, and elsewhere, I'm not seeing it right away, but Jeremiah acknowledges that God searches him, and therefore God can vindicate him. So Jeremiah knew not to trust in man and to look to God. Okay, the last section then, verses, as I've divided things here, verses 11 through 13. Again, they're connected with what went before, but I'd like to point out the contrast, because I'll probably forget to make it. Verse 11, there's the contrast between looking to riches as the great fulfillment, the great glory, and then in verses 12 and 13, looking to the Lord, especially as he reveals himself in his ordinances. That contrast is one which should be obvious to everyone. If you had the choice between eternal fellowship with God and having a big bank account now, what would you take? Well, most people take the big bank account in this life, and that's the... Well, okay, I'll sharpen the distinctions a little bit, but that's the basic idea here. We have such a far surpassing glory in God that this foolish trusting in riches is only a contemptible sort of thing. Now, the point of verse 11 is, first of all, verse 11 isn't about the rich person, narrowly speaking. It's about the one who gets riches, but not by right. So as we say, ill-gotten gain. This is the person who is corrupt, perhaps by oppression or in other ways he gets wealth. And what it says about him is that his wealth will leave him in the midst of his days, and at the end he will be a fool. The ill-gotten gain will not last. Now, as you may remember, the word fool is Nabal. And we have in the Nabal, the person Nabal, remember Nabal, Abigail's husband, who refused to give of his wealth to David, just to share a little bit, and as David and his men came looking for an opportunity to have a little relief from their privations in the wilderness, Nabal said, basically, "Who are these guys? There are all kinds of ruffians around these days." And Nabal refused to share any of his wealth. Well, Nabal is a good illustration of this, because in the end of his days, he was shown to be a fool. Just a plain fool. What could be more stupid than to shun the one who had protected and cared for you? Abigail, his wife, had a lot more sense than he did, and he was shown in the end of his days to be a fool. I think the commentators are right to point out that it's not, strictly speaking, the point that they are only a fool when they die, but that they're shown to be fools when they die. That is... At his end, he will be a fool. He will be revealed to be one. So this idea is just as the wisdom literature makes much of the contrast that we saw in verses 5 through 8, so there's much in the wisdom literature about the foolishness of trusting in wealth. And I put up some references from Proverbs and also Psalm 49, which is a great parallel passage to this that talks about the unreliability of wealth. And also in the New Testament, in Luke 12, remember how the rich man built his barns, and they weren't enough, so he built larger barns? And what did God say to him? Called him a fool, and said his wealth would vanish, as it were, in the sense that he couldn't take it with him. He was about to die, so his wealth would do him no good. So that's the point in verse 11. And then to rush on to verses 12 and 13, the contrast there is so beautiful. God is set forth particularly in his glorious high throne. And the reference is the place of our sanctuary, I think, is especially to the temple, and if you want a particular location in the temple, it would be where God showed his glory between the cherubim, where he's sometimes said to reign. Now, of course, God reigns in heaven, but his presence was particularly shown in the worship of his people in that Holy of Holies. And that contrast is that we have a glorious presence of God shown especially in his ordinances. And let me, again, I'll read from what Matthew Henry had to say. All good men have a high value and veneration for the ordinances of God and reckon the place of the sanctuary a glorious high throne. This is important because Jeremiah often has to criticize their people for the attachment to the temple. I already referred to chapter 7. Remember, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord is this. You know, Jeremiah pointed out that they were clinging to the temple as if it were some protection for their wickedness. Because that's pretty stupid. It wasn't any protection for their wickedness. But Jeremiah wasn't saying that the temple was a glorious place because of the presence of God. Right? He was, and that same contrast comes up at the end of the chapter, which I read, where he promises that in the days of blessing there will be a complete use of the ceremonial system. And I think that's really prefiguring the work of Christ. But Jeremiah wasn't a critic of the temple system per se. After all, he was a covenant man, right? He cared for the covenant that God has made. And so he emphasizes here particularly the proper attitude that God's glory is shown in the temple. The temple isn't an empty building with a promise attached to it, right? Come here, nothing bad will happen. That's the way they looked at it. The temple is a building full of the glory of God. And if you enter into his presence with a sincerity of heart, according to his will, then you will find it a glorious throne. And that's then the point in verse 13, all who forsake you shall be ashamed. It's that same idea of trusting in anything else that we saw before leads to, really means forsaking God. So all who forsake God will be ashamed. It's a foolish thing to trust in anything else. It's a foolish thing to see glory anywhere else. And then a very, very interesting last part of verse 13. Those who depart from me shall be written in the earth. Now, there's a lot of conjecture about exactly what that means. It brings to mind images from the Old and New Testaments about, for example, the names of believers being written in heaven. Right? And here the idea is that their names are only written in the earth. But probably more directly is the idea that anything you write in the dust is pretty likely to be erased, as all small children find. Or if you like, a slightly different more metaphor. If you ever have written with chalk on the sidewalk and then it rains, you'll find how long your writing lasts. And so the idea is that their memory will be effaced, to use the words of Psalm 9. Their memory will be gone. And this may be the sort of idea that Christ was using when they brought to the woman accused of adultery and he stooped down and wrote on the earth. This may be the same sort of idea. That itself has a multitude of interpretations. But there's certainly a striking contrast. Their names will be written, no doubt. But this is not an honorable writing of the name, however it's to be understood. And it ends with this contrast because they have forsaken the Lord, the fountain of living waters. And, of course, that goes back to the verse we looked at in chapter 2, verse 13. They hew for themselves cisterns. Cisterns were very unpleasant things to drink out of, especially when you got to the bottom. And what a foolish thing it is to forsake the Lord, the fountain of living waters, for your own sources of life and joy. So this section is a section of tremendous contrast between the hope and joy and fruitfulness of trust in God and the barrenness and futility. What could be more futile than writing in the dust or having your name written in the dust? The futility of the way of trusting in ourselves and in the arm of the flesh. I'm almost there. I wonder, there's one, I left out a bunch of quotations, so there's one I really like from Trapp that I wanted to read on verse 11. This idea of getting riches that will leave him in the midst of his days. He says this, God sometimes giveth wealth to the wicked as men put money into an earthen bottle, which, that they may get it out again, they break the bottle in pieces. And so that's the picture that God gives wealth, but in the end he will destroy the vessel to which he has put it. there are lots of good comments that I can read. But let me stop there and see if you have comments or questions on this half of the chapter.
Probably the pursuit of wealth, the love of money, is the clearest metaphor for trusting in man.
That's so an
excellent
point.
Even though it manifests in many different ways, that's the probably the pithiest.
Yeah, that's helpful. So that ties together the themes of the chapter, that, and also, of course, shows the futility of it, because it will depart from you. Or more precisely, we might say, we will depart from it in some cases, at least when we die. In many cases, it departs from them, though.
And in our case, the metaphor even goes a little farther. It gets made out of paper.
That little atom is another story, as they say. Okay. The other comments. That little atom is another story is a literary allusion to a cartoon that only some of us would be old enough to remember. Anyway, let's stop here.